You're listening to the Reinvest Podcast, where each Tuesday we will show you how to reclaim, reconnect, and refocus your life by bringing you the top real estate professionals in the industry. We'll pull back the curtain so you can implement these tools and tactics to build generational wealth. Your hosts, Garrett Gatton and Seth Simonillo.
What up, Reinvest listeners? Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Reinvest Podcast. Got some exciting stuff going on in our company, Level 5 Capital for the Reinvest Podcast. Got some big goals here that we are tackling. Hopefully here, I don't know, in the next quarter, we can kind of unveil what that's going to be. So stay tuned for that. But today we've got a really intriguing episode that a lot of people maybe haven't thought about, or if they hear it, they would feel some sort of way about it, but we're going to debunk that today.
or it seems the opposite. So I don't know. It just almost seems like,
which way is it going to go?
Exactly.
And with us today to, hopefully bring some clarity to some of this is Adrian Smood. Did I say that right, Adrian?
You did. You got okay. It right. Adrian awesome. Smood.
Awesome. So Adrian, give us a little intro. Who are you? The company that you started, and give us a little context to how you got into real estate investing.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me. And I am from Plant City, Florida. Winter Starway Capital of the World. It's actually going on right now. It's in between Tampa and Orlando. It's a little town. Grew up there, Florida native. And I got started as a real estate investor as a tenant. Actually, okay. A really bad tenant.
Oh, so
my friends and I got eviction notices for spaghetti wrestling parties, mud wrestling parties.
Oh my gosh.
Putting wrestling, and even parking a motorcycle in the living room.
Wow. How'd you get a motorcycle in a living room?
I mean, were you like in an apartment or what were you in?
Nope. It was a single family house. And my friend's reasoning for parking it there was, so in Florida, you may be a little surprised, but it can get cold. Like 40, 45 degrees some mornings.
Oh, stop it.
But no joke, he didn't want to wait for his motorcycle to warm up. So he parked it in the living room and just brought it in through the sliding glass door.
Why not? Wow. Well, to be fair, everything's on a slab there, right? So
yes. Essentially, you don't want to rent to 20-year-old Adrian and his friends. And as real estate investors, we're really problem solvers. And I didn't realize that at the time, but I solved the problem. So I bought a house, moved all my friends in that helped me get evicted, and I became the landlord to understand why we were a problem. Mm. But what I did that was really smart is I divided my mortgage up amongst my friends, renting out the rooms. So I lived for free at 20 years old, not with mom and dad, which is really, really cool.
Yeah. Right.
A few years later, I said, hey, I'm going to do it again. I went and bought another house listening to the banks, and they said, don't worry. You can refinance this in a few years. You'll lose a little bit every month. Real estate goes straight up. A few years later, real estate was coming down. Remember that big recession that we had?
Oh, interesting.
Yep. And I had the adjustable rate mortgage that we've all read about. Yep. You know it's coming. So my payment went from a little bit every month of his loss to a little bit more. My ego held on, and I decided, nope, it's too much. And I sold it basically at the bottom as a short sale. So obviously a ding to my credit, ding to my ego, but it was really a ding to my integrity. I didn't do what I said I was going to do. And that comes back in play. So I'll fast forward. I bought some more houses, but then I found like this time. So I've been wrong about real estate direction for a really long time, 8-9 years. I thought we were at the top, like just can't keep going. That short sale was in the back of my head, but that's what forced me to look for something new, which is how I found the mobile homes, the niche of mobile homes. And since then, I have been selling off my single family homes to buy mobile homes, which I'm sure we'll dig into the reasonings of that. And today's business is I buy and rent a single unit mobile home. That can be a single wide, double wide, but one unit, not a park, and rent it out long-term. That is my main business. And we keep it all in a small little part of Central Florida.
So, anybody, you know, I've kind of noticed this driving down into the South, you know, if it's North, South Carolina, Georgia, even Florida, that's a really common thing to see is a standalone mobile home on a piece of land, not in a park, usually in a rural area. Is that the kind of property that we're talking about?
Exactly. And I get that comment often, but mobile homes, these single units, they're everywhere. They're in all the states. They're in Alaska. Now, do we have more in Florida? Yes. Texas is the only state that has more, but they're a larger state.
Right.
They're in all the states. A lot of times, like you said, they are more rural, and we're not usually looking for them is one reason we don't see them as often.
And honestly, we have a decent amount in, yeah, in our county.
That's true.
I mean, we've sold several, and we see them get listed semi-often on the MLS even.
So I think what going back to kind of your time as a tenant, first of all, the self-awareness and the humility to admit that you are an awful tenant. I admire that. And then it would be a sick twist of irony if you became the landlord and then evicted all of your friends. That'd be really funny. but so what did you learn once you kind of became, you know, a property owner? What kind of shifts took place in your mindset that you didn't understand when you were a tenant?
Well, I decided that we needed to take better care of the property. I mean, that was one of the big ones. We did have some crazier parties, but I was like, we can't keep doing this. Like, I have to do all the repairs. I'm the one it comes back to. And in that phase of renting out by the room, one big thing I learned is everyone's level of what clean is very different. Wow. And apparently I'm a pretty clean person compared to others.
So, I feel like this is not good.
That was a little bit of tension, but I made more than a traditional rental and I got to live for free. Yeah, and eventually I started making money. And so that was just such a cool thing. You know, I've always had a little bit of the entrepreneur mindset. I grew up in a family that has owned small businesses. So it wasn't that hard for that. I was like, I don't want to work a regular job. You know, I did work at Walmart for a bit. I worked at a restaurant for a few weeks, the YMCA for a few months. But I didn't like someone telling me where I had to be. I was like, I like this real estate thing.
So in 2008, 2009, you alluded to the fact that your mortgage adjusted. That's when the crash happened. And you were really exposed. Okay. So then after that time frame, when that happened, how soon did you start investing in real estate?
Like, so I never lost that original house because I did buy it right and I was renting it right. The banks told me I could go 2 more years after that short sale. I could go and my credit would be okay and I'd buy another. Within 2 weeks of that 2 year time frame, they changed it to 3 years.
Wow.
So I was watching the clock and everything. And I was already looking at properties. Oh, I didn't want to wait any longer. So I had my girlfriend at the time go buy a house because banks would like her. I understood how the system worked enough. And so we started using her credit because she was more bankable than me.
Yeah. Prettier, easier to get along with. Yeah. Probably a lot of reasons, right?
Yep, exactly.
So you've been investing probably for the better part of 15 years.
About 20 years.
20 years.
Yeah. So I just passed 20 years.
So talk about that first, the first mobile home purchase, when the light bulb went off in your mind that there's something to this.
So why did I even buy a mobile home from the beginning? Let's start with that piece of it is I was frustrated not finding the returns that I really wanted and thought we could. Remember that short sale that has always stayed in the back of my head. It's one of the worst but best things that happened to me. So I was frustrated with the regular real estate, the single family. And at the time, I didn't really think I wanted multifamily. And at the real estate investor club I was at, I kept hearing the old seasoned investor, like the old meaning they had a lot of years. They've been in the business longer than I've been alive. They kept talking about mobile homes at some point in their career. I said, all right, let me check it out. Somebody brought me a mobile home that a friend had met there. And Jessica says, hey, my broker has a mobile home that needs to sell. I was frustrated not finding the returns. So secretly, my plan was this was either going to work or I was going to spend the rest of our money and we were going to get a big splat. And I'd study a bunch of successful people. They already had this splat story. So I was like, I'm doing one of the two. I'm not going to stay where I'm at anymore. Mm-hmm. I wanted more. And we had a good house. I mean, we were living off of her income. So if I just worked, we would have good income. But I knew I just wanted more freedom and everything. So I bought it for $16,000, made some mistakes. This is a single wide mobile home, three bedroom, one bath, 1965.
Wow.
0.09 acres.
So you bought the land and the mobile for $16,000.
0.09 acres.
That's yes.
A small lot.
That's tight.
And I made some mistakes. You know, I didn't have any official education on it or anything, but I was making money. Let's say I had $20,000 in it. I put a four rent sign out at $475 a month. I had applications. Now, years later, that person moved out and put a few more thousand in it. And I think it's rented now at $720 a month. Wow. So it's, that was the moment. I didn't even need the years later. It was that initial moment. I was like, this is much better returns. And I didn't even fully understand how to use a financial calculator at the time. I was decent enough, but I was like, this works. So I went out and bought some more, and they kept being about the same returns. So then my coach at the time was really questioning me, what do you really want from real estate? What are you really doing here? You know, I would say the typical answer. I want some appreciation, some cash flow, depreciation. You know, I want a piece of everything. He's like, no, what do you really want right now? And he kept digging down with that question. And I said, cash flow. That's what I really want. He said, well, let's forget the rest for the moment. Focus on cash flow, and then we can go after the rest later. Hmm. And that's exactly what I did. And mobile homes produce a much higher cash flow. Now, I've gotten all these other benefits, but I focused on the one that I really wanted. And if it wasn't fantastic cash flow, I wholesaled it.
Wow. Hmm. Interesting. So you said that the bulk of your portfolio is in Plant City, Florida?
Within 30 minutes of Plant City. So Lakeland is a city a lot of Nashville people have heard of because it hit a bunch of newspapers and the best city to invest in.
So talk about some of the, once you got in the game, you started kind of learning, okay, it's probably labor intensive, but the returns are much higher. What were some of those misnomers that people had about mobile home parks that you kind of either confirmed or realized that there wasn't as much truth as people made them out to have?
So let's just go with a big one that they're all trailer trash. I'm putting the air quotes out there. You know,
right.
Country songs and Netflix specials and Hollywood have made it that all mobile homes are trailer trash. Well, I haven't found that to be true. Are there some? Yeah. But there's also some single family houses that if you put wheels underneath it, you'd call them trailer trash.
Right.
Apartments, everything. So it's not the unit. It's the area, how you fix it up, the condition is what I have found. So that stereotype isn't always true. Who are most of our residents that live in our properties? It's a blue collar, handyman, handy women. Mm-hmm. They move in and it's not uncommon that we drive by a month or so later and they have fixed up and made it their home and they take a lot of pride in their home. So that is one of the biggest myths out there. And we now buy in an area they want to live in. So we go shopping for our avatar resident. Mm-hmm. And if it's not an area, if it's an area that's going to be really low end, it's not a great property, we really don't want to buy it. Now, sometimes we'll buy it and sell it to another investor or something, but our ideal resident is a blue collar, handyman, handy woman that wants to stay a really long time and take care of the home.
So I think one of the initial flags in my mind and someone else's mind is how do you finance something like this?
Oh yeah. Yep. Let's break up financing into two sections, the 1960s and 70s mobile homes, and then the 1990s and newer, and then the 80s is going to be kind of a blend. How do you finance a 1960s and 70s? You don't go to a bank. So if you are watching, you can see this one behind me. It's a 1960s. It comes with most of its siding. It's a two-bedroom, one bath, quarter acre. I'm still making payments on this. It's about to be paid off. It is not to a bank. They don't like it. But owner financing is not that uncommon in these older ones because the owners know there's no bank financing.
Right.
They don't just tell me, well, why don't you just go to a bank? I used to get that excuse all the time when I tried to get it with the single family world. And for the last decade and a half, they've been right. The banks have been the best option. So owner financing and the other big one is private money. Mm-hmm. So friends and family, they have some maybe lazy IRA money, CISA account, like different accounts or just money in their account that they want to make a better return. And that is one of the biggest ways, those two, of how we finance the older ones. Now, if you go into the newer ones, the 1990s and newer, you can get in the 80s. So here, technically, you can go all the way back to June 15th, 1976. That's a really important year in the mobile home space. The federal government stepped in, HUD, and said, we're going to make a standard for these things. Before that, they made them different all over the country, no real standards of quality. So that is a solid year. There's no banks that go older than that. Mm. Can you get financing in a late 70s mobile home? Yeah, it's not going to be very easy because to bring it up to the quality that they want is probably going to cost you more. So that's why the 80s start becoming a little bit more like, yeah, I'll put some money into that. Who's going to finance those? The community banks and credit unions. And you just have to keep asking them because there's usually at least one or two in each market that they will finance them.
Now they'll finance it to you. They'll finance it to you knowing that you're going to use it as an investment purpose.
That is a little bit more difficult. So me personally, my business, I don't have any banks involved in it. I'm completely human based. It's a decision I've made. Maybe I pay a little bit more, but I just get a little bit more fulfillment writing the check to a friend I know versus the bank. Mm-hmm. And now if you're going to fix and flip it, the community banks are better. I'm sure there's some out there, but it is going to be more difficult for an investor because we know that the banks, they want to owner occupant a little bit more,
right? But
they are out there.
Interesting. So in our area, just because I think a lot of people think of mobile homes on land that aren't in a park, usually it's going to be an acre, a half acre. So, but you had said some of these are on 0.09 acres. So is there a different model in Florida like that you can take a residential lot and slap a mobile home on it, no problem? Or are they selling lots individually in a park that you can actually own the title to the land on? Or are these country lots?
Great questions. I don't get asked that one very often. You're noticing the differences. There are some mobile home parks that I have found in our area that what they did is they subdivided up and then sold off the home and land together. Mm. And so those are typically pretty small slivers of land. That's what I built a lot of my business on because all I cared about is cash flow. Remember when I started out? Now I want some equity and a little bit better appreciation. So now I do look for the half acre, acre, acre and a half lots.
Yeah.
I call those my lotto tickets because those are typically in a path of progress. One day a builder is going to say, I want that. And I say, sweet, I want a really big check. And until then, I'm going to cash flow it with a mobile home.
Right.
So it can be both. It just kind of depends on the area. Now, can we move a new one onto that 0.09 acres? Probably not. I haven't checked the code in that county, but my guess is no. The septic is going to, and the well on that one, it's just going to be too close. It's not up to code. Mm-hmm. So I do run that risk. It burns down or the big oak tree falls on it. And I probably am in trouble.
Are you able to get these things insured in Florida? Like, are you getting insurance on these?
The insurance question. So if the listeners don't know, insurance in Florida is a nightmare no matter what you're insuring.
Yeah.
We are fitting a lot of our joke stereotypes of Florida being a mess. And we are right now in the insurance world, and mobile homes are not an exception to that. We have lost our ability to get insurance on some of our older ones in Florida, so the 60s and 70s. I have to get a 4-point now inspection pass, where in the past I didn't have to do that. So what have I done personally? I went to self-insuring more properties than I already did. I was already self-insuring some. And when I say self-insure, I still mean I have liability coverage. I think liability is one of our biggest risks in the business. But if I can't get insurance to cover the home, that means I have to buy at stronger numbers, a bigger discount. So yeah. I see this as an opportunity. Some people aren't going to be willing to go without insurance because I think insurance is really about sleeping well at night. And there's going to be less investors that can do it, willing to. If you go to the private money and the owner financing, you don't have to have insurance. Bankroll, you do. So I see this as an opportunity to be able to help more people out and then make more money.
Because you can kind of use it as like a negotiating tactic, kind of like, hey, I won't be able to get insurance on this. Need you to help me finance it. That way
exactly.
The bank's not worried about it. Okay. So
exactly. Here's my quick tip on the owner financing. All of mine that I've gotten that way, which is a handful or two, whatever number you ask me, I say yes, if it's on payments. So I'm not going to try to beat you up on price. If you're willing to give me a payment that I can still cash flow the right way, I have overpaid properties. But it's because you're giving me the financing that I really like. And I'll pay you for a little bit longer as long as I can cash flow it very safe.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. No, that makes sense. So talk about a lease agreement. So I think a lot of us are thinking, okay, tenants, and some kind of a lease in place that would be related to a brick and mortar building, single family house, apartment. Are there any nuances or things in a lease when you're doing it with a mobile home that are different than a conventional lease with a single family house?
This is another really common question and myth, and that goes along with that quote unquote trailer trash. When we are renting them the home and land together, we're keeping it as a, think of it as a single family rental.
Okay.
Because it is. No, we have the exact same leases. We don't change any of that. Now, my leasing process, property management process, is a lot about expectations. But we don't change any of that. If you're running a mobile home park, yes, you have different leases because you're renting them just the unit and not the dirt underneath it. You're leasing them the ability to park the mobile home there. So that is where there is a difference. But in the single unit where it's still a single family home, it's the same thing.
So I was just thinking, it just kind of hit me because this whole time I'm thinking, I'm like, man, it would be really hard to keep some of these units in check and a lot of maybe just a lot of maintenance issues. But I was kind of thinking back at this last year. So we bought a mobile home park, an actual park, you know what I mean? So there's a bunch of mobiles in there. Some of them are park owned. Some of them, you know, a lot of them are resident owned. But a lot of our issues have been the winter and like getting calls like, hey, my pipes froze over. Hey, my heat tape stopped working. So the pipes froze over, or even some of the park or some of the resident owned homes, they're like, are calling us and like, hey, my water froze. And I'm like, well, you own the home. It's your responsibility.
But we're still, give you a number for the plumber.
We're still getting called on it. But being in Florida, that probably doesn't happen.
Correct. Yeah. We don't have to deal with that. You know, but is that much different than a wood frame home that the pipes can freeze underneath there? You know, we don't get that at all in Florida. But so a lot of that to me is educating them that they do have to take care of it and maybe just taking care of it for them so you have less headaches. There's times that we do stuff that we don't have to do because I don't like headaches in life.
All right. So this is the bit in my mind, this is probably the crux of what maybe some of the skepticism or the objection that you might get. Construction materials of the mobile home and the maintenance cost of trying to repair a mobile home or do a turn on a mobile home before a new tenant, and that eroding your cash flow because it's very difficult to do that. So how do you guys mitigate that, navigate that, and keep from, you know, pouring money into something that you can't get back out of it?
Pouring $5,000 into a mobile home that maybe only cash flowed, you know, $5,000 or $6,000 for the year or something like that. I mean, I don't know.
I love this question because this is the mindset challenge besides the stereotype that it's all trailer trash that keep a lot of people out of it, which means they give me all their deals. Right, I'm going to keep those two sections again. The 1960s and 70s mobile home, I am probably not going to fix that up super nice. Because as you said, there's not a lot of value there, especially if it's going to appreciate a little bit, but not like something else. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to make that safe and livable. That is not pretty. It's going to be safe and livable, which means I'm most likely going to get the blue collar handyman, handywoman, because they're going to come in and say, hey, can I paint? Can I replace these floor covers? Like, this carpet's old and dingy. And I'm going to say yes. So that is part of my property management system, is I want to attract that person there. I have to run those numbers from the very beginning when I buy it. Mm-hmm. And so on those older ones, yeah, we put maybe 5 or 10 into it. I don't like to put any money into it. I don't like to paint. We don't touch the walls typically unless there's something unsafe.
Right.
Now on the newer ones, the 19, 90s and newer. So the newest one I've ever owned is a 1999. Mm-hmm. Those, I will typically put more money into it. My contractor right now has been convincing me to paint. I don't like painting because my blue car handyman, handy woman will paint. And right. It attracts that type of person. But he has been convincing me, and he makes my life easy. So I have been doing it some. But those properties have typically been on a little bit larger acreage. So my rents are higher on those. So I have been putting a little bit more money into it. When we really put some more money into it, we go to Home Depot or Lowe's and buy the exact same materials that you buy for any house. Mm. Mm-hmm. We can do that on the older homes as well. So let's say in an older home, we do have to replace some walls. We're not going to go and put mobile home materials in it. We're going to buy 2x4s, drywall, and we're going to do it the same. That is the upgrade, quote unquote. Sometimes if it's just a little section, we'll put some wall panel back there. But a lot of times we're just going to spend a little bit extra and put the exact same building materials, because in the long run, I believe it's worth it.
So kind of land the plane with us on the strategy. Where have you been able to get to in terms of the size of your portfolio, and what has that done for your cash flow?
My big example I love to give is in 2019, we decided to sell a house, one of the single family houses. The way I decided to sell anything I've ever sold, besides if it's a headache or not, but my main thing is I go to the numbers. What is my net equity after I sell it, you know, pay taxes, pay broker's fees, everything? What is that? What type of return is that making me on my net cash flow? So this house was making me, I think it was like 5.6% on its net. So I said, oh, I can make more than that in mobile home space. So I did a 1031 exchange. Most people go from like multiple properties into bigger and bigger, bigger. I sold the one single family and bought 7 individual mobile homes with the land. 7 different parcels, 7 different sellers. And it was work, you know, hustling around to find 7 in that little time period. I started early, by the way, before we actually sold.
Right, right.
Well, my cash flow went up 857%. I went from like $311, I think, to $3,000 and some change. I don't remember all the numbers perfectly. Wow. I went up 857%. That was the big, like, these things are amazing. Wow. You know, I already knew it, but the cash flow kept going up and up and up. Now, my headache value, because that's important to me.
You said your headache value?
When I started, huh?
Your headache value?
Yeah, the headache value. Like, if it costs me a headache, if I have to do work, I want to get paid even more.
Right.
So I call it the headache value. And when we're starting out, you know, we buy what we can afford. A lot of times we're willing to do headaches. And I had a lot of headaches at the beginning. Now, I don't like a headache property. Mm-hmm. If it's going to attract someone that's not going to stay a long time, or there's going to be a lot of maintenance and repairs that we talked about, I honestly don't want that property anymore. I can still make money. I can buy it, owner finance it to another investor. So now what we've been doing is we buy a nicer property, and then we sell off one of our not so nice ones, and just kind of upgrading the portfolio. I wanted to grow really fast. So I was willing to buy the older ones that no one else wanted. The banks won't finance. Everyone's super scared of them. And that's how I enabled my wife to retire at 29. That didn't mean we can go on vacations every day.
Right.
But she did not have to work. Our income was substituted by mobile homes.
So how many mobile homes do you have now? So from, you know, 2019, you bought that package of 7 or whatever it was. Kind of where are you at today? Do you have any single family houses still?
We take care of about 30 properties, a little over 30. I say take care of because I do have a few that we rent it from the owner super long term, like 40 years, with the right to sublet it out to someone else. They didn't want to sell, or they couldn't sell for whatever reason. We do have a handful that are single family houses, like a concrete structure. And that was because we got a handful at that one time. We manage all of them the exact same way. We don't have any management difference between the concrete homes and the mobile homes. So I'm really happy I did that. So I can tell people the management system's what matters, not the home itself, like the structure of the home itself.
Right. Wow. Wow. That's awesome.
All right. Well, let's jump into our smaller pocket segment. So, Adrian, go ahead and tell us about a deal that went wrong. What went wrong? What did you do? And then what did you learn from it?
So choosing one is very difficult because I have had a lot of things go wrong. We still do today. I will select one. I call it Tennessee, road name. And that one, I did not do the best inspection on it, but the numbers were so good. If I messed up some, it was still going to be a deal. But this property, if this was my first one, I would probably not be in the business. So what did I do wrong? Besides, like I said, I inspected it, but it wasn't anything like, and I didn't understand it well enough at the time. And I didn't bring someone in to help me understand it well enough. We had to do all of the subfloors, which I did not plan on that. The water heater, that was a massive mess.
Wow, all the subfloors.
The shit, which isn't that hard to do, but if it's not in your budget to do all of them, it's not fun.
Yeah,
it's really not very hard to replace them all. The shower felt very strong when I was in it and kind of pushing on it. But when we were working on the water heater, we saw that it was leaking and there was mold all on the back. So it had to be completely ripped out. And they had upgraded it, quote unquote. They had put actual tile there. So it wasn't as easy to just kind of rip down the board. We actually had to rip out tile, which is not ever fun. One of the other big things, we had two big headaches on it. The septic went bad, and I didn't realize it was bad.
Wow.
Ooh.
Yeah, so we ended up having to redo the septic tank.
What kind of numbers is it out there in Florida for a septic tank?
You can be from like 2,000 to 15,000. So a lot of it depends on the water table, if you have to do an above ground or not. We got by pretty lucky on this one that it wasn't very much, but it still wasn't in the budget to do anything to the septic.
Yeah.
So the person before that owned it, they had done some of their own work. So there were some 90 degree bends in the plumbing. You don't do that in the septic world.
Nice.
It makes sense. I just didn't know that. And I had seen it, but you know, I'm not a septic guy.
Right.
Yeah.
The other big thing is there is this massive oak tree and I did not have the money or the budget to take it down. But what I did want to do is take down some pretty big limbs that were like right over the home. Part of my theory, I don't know if it would work or not, is it would put the weight the other way and it would fall away from the home. I don't know. But while they were cutting the limbs, they hit the roof. Mm. Now, luckily, I did check to make sure they had insurance.
Yeah.
That is, when you're working above the roof, that is such a liability.
Wow.
And I was there when they were using like this rope method where they tie it off, they cut the limb and it swings. Well, it swung and they had it mismeasured and hit the roof. And the guy in charge was super freaking out. At that moment, I was like, not a big deal to me. He has insurance. And I actually checked. I called them. I didn't just believe the piece of paper.
Right.
So we ended up fixing it without insurance and it ended up being a good deal to me. It was just this, I called it a property that kept on giving.
Yeah.
It kept giving me another problem. Every time I thought I had it solved, another problem came in.
How much were you over budget on that?
I would have to look it up. My guess is probably $8,000 to $10,000 over budget.
Wow.
But I still was making money. I mean, I was shooting for like a 30% return on my money. So I came down around a 20, a little lower.
Yeah. Bummer.
So it went from like fantastic numbers to still really good numbers.
Yeah.
Which is one reason, you know, we're dealing with smaller numbers. We're not in the $100,000, $200,000, $300,000. So an $8,000 oops really swings the return on your investment.
Yeah. Right.
But it's now today, we're actually selling it on owner financing. It's doing great. It's making really good money. Part of me wishes I didn't sell it because the land value has gone up there. But at the time, I needed to outsource my management because I was trying to grow really fast. So I did do a few more owner financing then. We still have to deal with Dodd-Frank and the SAFE Act and all of that. Mm-hmm. But I did more of that when I was in mega growth. Now I built a really good property management system that I'm less likely to sell it off because I like cash flow that lasts
forever.
Headache
value is not, you know, exorbitant, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I've gotten also to the point now that I will own or finance to investors that are just starting out. They have a few deals. So some of my mentors did that for me. And now I get the privilege to get to do that with other people. So it feels good. I make a lot of money and it feels good. It's like, that usually doesn't go together.
It's a win-win. Yeah.
That's awesome, dude. All right. Well, awesome stuff on that. We're going to go into what we call our little nugget. So Adrian, this is a part of our show where you give our listeners one practical takeaway piece of advice that they can implement to their business, to their development. What do you got for us?
Find what works for you, as in some type of mindset. I'm a very big Miracle Morning guy by Hal Elrod. That is my one thing. I've got to do some variation of that every single day so that business goes better. Personal life goes better. Also, it helps keep me on track of that steadiness of that. Because I think where we give up and struggle the most is when times get really tough. It's easy when it's going straight up. But when times get tough, that's when people give up. And that's usually right before the breakthrough of something really good happening. So some type of morning routine or something that brings positivity into your mindset will help you keep going, because it will get tough at some point. And it's going to get tough again at some point for me. And I always go back to, what is my little basics that help keep my mind centered?
Yeah, if you're not dependent on the circumstances to give you that fix of dopamine, you know, or encouragement, but you already have something that's coming from your internal dialogue and you're just from within inside yourself, you don't have to fluctuate with the circumstances. Mm-hmm. You can keep that steady course.
Helps us be much more steady through all of life. You know?
Right.
Yeah, that's a really good, I like the dopamine. I've never thought of it in that manner, but that's really what's kind of happening here too.
Yeah.
Or cortisol. That's the fear one. But no, I think that's huge. And I feel like personally, that's something I'm always battling, is finding that center and that foundation to implement in my life. I think the older you get, the easier that becomes, because just I've seen the progression in my life, getting married, having kids, kind of being established in some kind of a career. It's like I'm getting more grounded in understanding the value of that consistency. And it's kind of like you underestimate, you know, what you can do in 5 years, but you overestimate what you can do in a year, right? And so you got to have those things that kind of set you up for the long game. So what's been one of the best resources in your personal or business development?
My networking. I'm a networker. I love to connect with others, learn from other people. So my networking. So I have someone I can call on any topic that's in my world today. Because when I network, I truly care. I actually want to know about you. Mm-hmm. I'm not just saying it for a business purpose, like to a transaction. But networking, that's a long-term game. It's not an overnight, so people don't get that quick fix and they don't want to keep going. Keeping those relationships going, I'm in a bunch of masterminds. That's part of those, get even tighter relationships. Mm-hmm. But there's a power of the network.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And that's been a reoccurring theme, but I think you made an important distinction that there's got to be authenticity behind it.
Yes.
And it doesn't mean that obviously, you know, you're trying to gain something from those relationships, but you can feel a lot better about it when you're also giving and it's reciprocal.
Right. When you're making it a win-win and you're not just like sucking the life and resources out of someone. Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody can identify somebody that it is that, right? And we don't want to be that. So.
Yeah, we can find something about everyone's conversation that we really love. Most people like traveling, and I love to travel. So I want to steer the conversation that way versus their cats. I like cats, but I can't talk about cats. I get about 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and you can tell I am not.
10 minutes, 10 minutes would be a long time. That would be forever to talk about cats. So,
but there's so many massive cat lovers out there. I mean, I know my sister-in-law has a best-selling book about cats.
Like, no kidding.
Seriously?
It's still one of the top search things on the internet.
What?
I have some students that are making their mascot about cats.
Dude, what is it? What's the name of the book?
Chunky cats.
No way. We're going to look this up right now. Oh,
so that's a niche within a niche. If you want to get like that topic of it, they're fat cat lovers on top of cat lovers. C-H-O-N-K. Chunky cats.
Oh, C-H-O.
Victoria. And so
that
shows it like if you love and can relate with someone. So she found in Darren COVID that there's these fat cat lovers, chunky cats, they call them, hundreds of thousands of people in Facebook groups.
That's crazy.
But, you know, like now I have that for a fat cat lover. I can like talk about and relate, but yeah. I still don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole because they're just going to feel that like, I want to talk about travel. Like, let's talk about that. I relate with that. Everyone has a wish list of travel. So
Adrian,
that's
I feel like your affiliation with a cat would be like, I have a lot of cats peeing my rentals. So that's okay, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
That's funny, man. Adrian, what does it look like for people to find out more about what you've got going on, your brand? I see on your shirt if you're watching on video, and follow your success.
I am all over the internet on different social medias. I'm on everything. I'm not TikTok yet. I'm a little too old for that. I'm getting someone to help me out. But lifestyle-rei.com. And especially for all the listeners, if you go to lifestyle-rei.com/reinvest, and I know you're going to put the link in there. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have a PDF there that you can download to debunk the 14 top myths that I have found about investing in mobile homes to help upgrade the mindset a little bit more. And you can follow me on any social, send me a message if I can help. I love helping. As you can tell, I love to talk about real estate and even more about mobile homes.
Well, dude, your authenticity it comes through. And you know what we've learned in the investment community as we've become investors, as we rub shoulders with other investors, there really is that transparency and a sharing mindset, kind of like there's enough for everybody. And I don't have to have the corner on information or a strategy. And that's been encouraging for myself as people more seasoned than I am have imparted that to me, you know? Yeah. And so that now I see that in you wanting to give back and pour into other investors.
That's exactly it. My mentors taught me. And now I almost feel slight obligation to pass it on. If not, it stops and it dies.
Right.
And I thank you both for having the podcast because you're doing all the work on this side, or you and your team. I show up and have fun. Yeah. There's a lot of work that goes behind the scenes of running a podcast. So thank you for having the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely, we appreciate it. It's our pleasure. We enjoy it. So thank you for coming on today.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me. And like I said, if I can help you guys or anyone else, I'm here.
Awesome. Thank you, man.
As always, excited that you joined us on another episode of the Reinvest Podcast. If this episode added to your tool belt or left you feeling inspired, go ahead and share it with a friend. Stay tuned every Tuesday for new episodes. And if you want to get in touch with us, go to our LinkedIn or Facebook profiles and shoot us a message. Move farther, reach higher, and grow deeper. See you next time.